The recent salmonella outbreak has now made more than 1,000 people sick. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it makes this the worst case of food contamination in several years. Federal health officials still suspect raw tomatoes were the source, but they're also looking for evidence of salmonella in other salsa ingredients, including jalapeno and serrano peppers and cilantro. Regardless of what fruit or vegetable is to blame, the outbreak has taken a big toll on the tomato business, as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates now reports.
California provides about half of the domestically grown produce that's sold in U.S. markets. Some of it stays in the state, like the fruits and vegetables being sold here at the weekly farmers market in downtown Culver City. There are gorgeous peaches in full blush, picture-perfect carrots, and aromatic basil. But the overflowing pyramids of tomatoes that would normally be here aren't much in evidence this week.
Maybe these farmers don't choose to bring them because their sales are so low because of the press.
That's Donald Yasukochi. He owns Valley Heights Ranch in Oceanside. Even though the FDA doesn't suspect California tomatoes, the salmonella scare has clearly hurt California growers who are just starting to harvest their tomatoes. Yasukochi estimates his own sales are down about 60%, but he feels fortunate that tomatoes aren't the bulk of his crops.
We don't have big acreage of tomatoes, but the people with big acreage, I mean, it's really killed them.
Killed is a painfully accurate description for Tom Nassif.
For our industry, this is tantamount to economic capital punishment.
Nassif is president and CEO of Western Growers, a cooperative association of farms in California and Arizona. The FDA warnings have depressed Western tomato sales so thoroughly, Nassif says, that some of his members say there's no point in even bringing their produce to market.
Our folks are not harvesting, many of them. They're letting them rot on the vine, or they're out there bulldozing the plants in the fields in the hope that maybe they can put in some other crop that may gain them some revenue to make up for the lost revenue in tomatoes.
Nassif believes that when the FDA issues warnings before it has a good handle on the possible culprit, the economic devastation goes far beyond farmers.
The people who pick in the field, the workers who grow it, the workers who harvest it, you affect the packing shed workers, which affects the truckers.
The biggest fear, Nassif says, is that this year's tomato scare could end up being last year's spinach scare, which affected markets worldwide.
These outbreaks and advisories have long-term effects on consumption patterns. We never regained our market in spinach, even though that was an isolated incident potentially in one field or one processing plant on one day.
Back at the farmers market, Colleen Sutherland admits the advisories have put a dent in her business at Lark Farms.
People were just scared because of the news that tomatoes and not knowing where they came from.
Robin Mergio shops farmers markets in order to know where her produce comes from. She explains why she's not afraid to eat tomatoes from Lark Farms' Denise Charles.
I come here to buy tomatoes this very stand every week, and so I always get delicious tomatoes. Nothing's ever been wrong with them, so
hydroponically grown in a greenhouse, so they're not sprayed with anything. So you're not going to, there's no risk.
For the nation's tomato farmers, though, perceived risk is proving to be as economically devastating as the real thing. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
For Kitchen Window, this is Bonnie Wolf. Susan Russo is a food writer in San Diego. She publishes stories, recipes, and photos on her cooking blog, Food Blogger. She has written about watermelons for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today from San Diego. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So it is watermelon season. How long is watermelon season?
It's actually a long season. It runs from May through October, but it peaks in July and August because the watermelons really like the heat of the summer.
So are they only grown in hot places?
Well, they're actually grown in 44 states in the United States, but really only five states produce the vast majority of the watermelons we eat, and they include California, Florida, Texas, Georgia, and Arizona.
Warm states.
Mm-hmm.
All the watermelon we eat here, we grow. We don't import watermelon?
No, we do. We actually import watermelon mostly from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that's primarily during our off-season because Americans have gotten used to having watermelon available 12 months of the year. But the domestic ones that are grown are available primarily May to October.
Well, Americans like watermelon, according to your story. It's
yes.
a pretty big market.
Yes. Americans oftentimes cite watermelons and strawberries as their favorite fruit.
Really?
And yeah, and apparently in 2007, we grew over 4 billion, with a B, pounds of watermelon in this country. And Americans eat over 16 pounds of it every year. So I think it's safe to say it's definitely one of our favorites.
And in your piece, you talk a lot about how to choose a good melon, which I found wonderful because I never know. And you talk a lot about something that I have definitely seen people do, which
yes.
is thumping the watermelon.
Yes. One day last year, we were at the farmer's market, and it was peak watermelon season, and I just saw, you know, probably a dozen people slapping and thumping away at these watermelons. And I turned to my husband and said, so what exactly is the point of thumping a watermelon? And so I started talking to people and just asking them their opinions and talking to farmers. And what I realized is there really isn't one definitive answer. Some people say you should listen for a deep resonant sound. Some people say it should be hollow. So I spoke to several farmers, and ironically, every single one I spoke to said not to use thumping as an indicator for ripeness, that it's not as accurate as many other methods of testing to see if a watermelon is ripe. What they suggest, actually, is to look at the melon and see if it's symmetrical. It should have a healthy sheen to the rind, and it's okay if it has scratch marks on it, because that's actually a sign that the watermelon has been pollinated by bees.
I thought that was so neat. I had never... Never heard of that.
I had never heard of that either, so I was really excited because I always thought that that was a sign of damage. But
right.
they said, in fact, that will indicate that the watermelon will be sweeter and juicier. And then they said, always lift up the watermelon and make sure that it's heavy for its size. Because watermelons are almost all water, 92% water, the heavier the watermelon, the juicier it should be. And then to also look at the underbelly of the watermelon, which should have a pale yellow creamy spot. That's where it was sitting on the soil, and it was ripening in the sun.
So you can tell if it's ripe, but not necessarily if it's sweet.
Yes. Unfortunately, you don't know that until you cut it and you taste it.
And you've eaten some good melons already?
I certainly have. I've been eating them since May. Because we produce so many here in California, we're able to get them at our local farmers market, so I've already had some delicious ones. But the best ones are yet to come. I think the best ones are in August and September.
Why is that?
Because from the farmers I've spoken to, they said that the hotter it gets, the sweeter the melons get, because they really love that heat. So the first crops that they harvest in May tend to not be quite as sweet and juicy as the ones that come later.
There are so many different kinds of watermelons now, it's hard to choose.
I know. Apparently, there are over 1,000 types of watermelons that are grown throughout the world. We have anywhere from 50 to a couple of hundred varieties here in the United States, but only a handful are actually available in most supermarkets. And probably most of us have purchased picnic watermelons, which are those long, oblong-shaped watermelons that are large, anywhere from 20 to 45 pounds, and they have the classic red or hot pink flesh inside and the black seeds. And those are the ones that I think most of us associate with summertime watermelon, growing up, having family cookouts, is the picnic watermelon.
So this is a sweet fruit, but in your piece you talk about using it in savory cooking. It seems that a lot more fruit is being used in savory dishes. Why is watermelon good in savory foods?
Well, watermelon is good because it's naturally crisp and juicy and sweet. You can pair it with many other contrasting flavors. So the key to cooking watermelon in savory dishes is to pair it with something salty or acidic or bitter or sour.
Well, I would recommend that everyone read your piece because you have some wonderful looking recipes.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie. This was fun.
InBev, the world's second largest brewer, was created when the Belgian company Interbrew bought the Brazilian brewer AmBev, now the Belgian-Brazilian Consortium. And look out when those Belgians and Brazilians get together. They're looking to acquire Anheuser-Busch, maker of some quintessentially American beers. InBev Busch, AnBevin, or this disturbing anagram of InBev and AnBusch, Shaven Cub Nib. Anheuser-Busch rejected InBev's offer last month, but the Belgian Brazilians are not giving up. Just today, they said they will try to remove the entire board of Anheuser-Busch in an attempt to add Bud, Michelob, and all the others to InBev's Bass, Stella Artois, and Beck's. That's the business part of the story. Now onto the beer part. Check out that list of beers I just read. The InBev beers, they're just better. They're tastier. They're more complex. They're less watery. Is part of Anheuser-Busch's problem that the beer just isn't that good? Let's ask Garrett Oliver, the brewmaster at the Brooklyn Brewery. Hello, Garrett.
How are you?
First, good. First, let's establish your independence. Brooklyn Brewery, not owned by a conglomerate, not looking to get bought by a conglomerate?
No, in fact, any number of conglomerates have made attempts to buy us, but no, we're pretty closely held. We're a completely private company, and we go our own way.
And do you think that the conglomerates, are, if they bought you, would try to change the recipes? Is that the worry?
I have no doubt they would try almost instantly. The materials and things that we're buying are pretty expensive, and InBev are known as ruthless cost cutters.
And so is it just a question of ingredients that makes, let's talk about Anheuser-Busch, that makes American beer taste like it does, which is to say, you know, mass-brewed American beer, kind of watery, or is it that they think that they've calculated the palate of Americans as wanting that beer?
Well, I think that for a long time they were correct. Americans maybe wanted beer that tastes like water because they didn't know any better, but these days people are drinking beer that tastes like beer, and that does require more expensive ingredients. It requires more time. So I think that that's certainly the direction that American food is going in, and American beer is going the same way.
Yeah, the American palate is becoming more sophisticated, but is there a way, I mean, I'm sure if we got Anheuser-Busch's corporate people in the room, they would scoff at you and I and saying, oh, what does this guy know? He's not in touch with, you know, middle America. But do you have counter evidence that even, you know, the normal Bud drinker's taste buds would just light up if he tasted yours or any other number of microbrews?
We see it every day. I mean, one problem that the Anheuser-Busch shareholders have is that Anheuser-Busch isn't growing. You know, their beers that taste kind of like water, well, they're growing at 1% or flat or down over the last several years, where last year, craft American beer grew by 12%. Brooklyn Brewery grew 26%. These are numbers that these big companies can't afford to ignore.
Yeah, and if you look at the Whole Foods and the Trader Joe's and all these other, you know, the American palate, it's just, even a place like Taco Bell's ascendancy shows that Americans are more willing than they were 50 years ago to try something more interesting. But that formula for the beer, for Coors and Miller and Budweiser, it really just hasn't changed in a century or half a century.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. The main maker that we all know of, supermarket white bread, is now bankrupt.
Wonder. You know,
because it's basically a bread facsimile, not really bread. Well, it's the same thing with beer. Americans want real food now, and they want real beer, and they're willing to step up and grab it. And this has been a real problem for these industrial beer makers.
What's your opinion of InBev's big brand, Stella Artois? Because in Belgium, it's not particularly seen as a gourmet beer.
No, it's thought of as something that you might drink if you have 15 minutes to kill on a train station, but that's pretty much it. The Belgians are laughing all the way to the bank. This is the cheapest beer possible. Even they don't like it over there, but it was sold to us with huge amounts of advertising, and I think that a lot of people just liked staying the name Stella Artois.
Do you think it's better than Budweiser?
Only marginally. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the slightest of differences, and it bears very little resemblance to traditional beer.
And we're talking about Pilsners, right, in each case?
Yes, Pilsners, which should have a nice, snappy bitterness to them, 100% malt, which means barley malt, which means they have a fuller flavor through the center. In other words, beer that tastes like beer. Stella does taste slightly better than Budweiser, but I wouldn't be reaching for either of them.
Are they right in thinking that Pilsner is the most populous type of beer?
Oh, that's certainly true. I mean, the golden style out of the 1850s sort of took over the world. However, people are now getting back a much wider range of beer. So the same way that we used to have one kind of bread, and now we have a whole aisle of bread, the same is certainly true of beer, too.
I know a decade or so ago, the big brewers were buying up microbreweries, and sometimes they were also doing these rebranding things, which kind of, I think, failed, where they had smaller brands like, not Red Bull, there was like a Red Dog thing that they did for a while. It didn't really work out. What happened with the microbreweries and the big brewers dancing together? What's the history of that?
Well, they had all kinds of colored animals and whatever else, and they did actually buy some smaller breweries, and those by and large didn't work. The one success they've had is Blue Moon, which of course is Coors, not as flavorful as the European counterparts, but at least a little bit better. But there aren't very many successful American breweries, small breweries, who are interested in being bought by a conglomerate like this because they can kind of see what happens.
What's Blue Moon? Is that a Hefeweizen? Is that
that is their best selling beer? Is the sort of so-called Belgian style white beer?
All right.
And that's Coors. And it's certainly more flavorful than regular Coors beer. But of course, as far as I'm concerned, that simply leads people in our direction.
Among the big brewers, are there any beers that they produce that you think, you know, are decent, at least decent?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, these big companies are perfectly capable of making wonderful, flavorful beer if they felt like it. But they've had a culture for such a long time of getting all the beer flavor out of beer that it's really taking them a long time to think about putting it back in. I have had beers, experimental beers made by these companies that are actually quite good. But they can't bring themselves to really get away from the mass market because the lower amount of flavor you put in something, the easier it might be to sell it to everybody at once.
Do you think that they're worried that if they come out with these more flavorful beers, it will really kind of call into question the big thing that they've been doing this whole time? I mean, it's not like soda, you know? Beer is supposed to be a little more sophisticated.
Well, it's not like soda at all. I mean, beer is one of the world's great beverages, and it has a much wider range of flavor, in fact, than wine does. You know, it goes from tasting like dark chocolate all the way to tasting very much like white wines. But we've only had this one industrial product. And as soon as they start selling all different types, then yes, the whole market is splintered. The way that they go about selling their beer is splintered, and they have to do what other types of food have to do, which is sell their beers to individual people,
right,
not just into the market as a mass.
And I think they just have this picture of millions of consumers grabbing the Coors or Miller or Michelob or Bud out of the fridge and staring at it going, what the hell was I thinking?
Well, it was so much easier. I mean, a very short time ago, all you had to do was put huge amounts of television commercials on the three major networks, which is all that anybody watched, and you had everybody all at once, and you had, you know, you have a few race cars, and you've got a bunch of neon signs, and you don't have to spend any money to actually put a decent product into the can because all the money goes for advertising. So it was really a very good model because almost all the money that you used to buy the beer was actually used to sell it to you.
Garrett, you're telling me you've never walked into the brewery and said, people, here's what we've got to do. Forget the taste. We've got to widen the mouth. We've got to have the can change color when it's cold, and we have to have a Swedish bikini team. You've never said that?
No, I'm still wondering what there's one of them that says that they have the coldest beer on earth. I'm still wondering exactly how that got past the legal department. It must be a fascinating place to work.
You know, you taste it and your tongue sticks to the beer. It's really wonderful. It's just the beer that gives back. And finally, my last question is, you know, part of the InBev plan is to sell Budweiser to Europeans. Is that going to work?
Well, the funny thing is that it actually could, because since some of the beer makers over there are not giving people as many new flavors as the creative craft brewers are in the United States, they are susceptible to being sold things by huge amounts of advertising too. So it could work. It certainly has worked in the UK and some places, but I don't think overall it's going to be a great sell. And America's overall standing in the world isn't wonderful right now. So, but then our dollar is kind of through the floor, so maybe that'll help them.
Garrett Oliver, brewmaster at the Brooklyn Brewery, author of The Brewmaster's Table, Discovering the Pleasures of Real Beer with Real Food. Thanks for a real good interview, Garrett.
Thank you.
Chances are, if you're cooking this weekend, then you may be using garlic. Love it or hate it. Garlic has been used by humans for almost 6,000 years, and not just a flavor for their food. Chester Aaron is a garlic farmer in Occidental California. He joins us from the studios of KRCB in Rohnert Park, California. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How long have you been a garlic farmer, Chester?
25 years.
Can you just off the top of your head just rattle off some of the varieties you have?
Oh, sure. I have Creole Red from Louisiana, Spanish Roja from Spain. My favorite is the Red Toch from the Republic of Georgia, Floja from Germany, the Xi'an from China, Pyongyang from North Korea, and so forth.
Now, I understand we almost had to reschedule this interview because you were stung by yellow jackets.
Correct.
What did you do? What was the first thing you did after you get stung? You got stung.
Curse.
No. What was the second thing you did?
The second thing I did was to immediately take a clove of garlic and rub it raw over the stinger. When I went into shock and went into Kaiser Hospital, the doctor said that the garlic actually helped.
Wow. So you're allergic to bee stings. Did you know the garlic would help you?
I have always used garlic, raw garlic, for wounds, scratches, and so forth. A lot of people years and years before me have done the same thing.
Wow. You cook with garlic, which I think is always the best part.
Even my morning coffee.
No.
Yes.
You must really love garlic if you put it in your morning coffee. You have some recipes for us, but they don't include garlic coffee. You have a collection. It's called The Great Garlic Book. And you gave us two recipes, appropriate recipes, for the 4th of July weekend. And the first one is for grilled stuffed trout. Where did this one come from?
This one was sent me by a chef in Poland. It's a sea trout, fresh trout. And I actually stuff it with the following. I grate 5 eggs into a bowl, and then I add crushed garlic, and I add butter and parsley and salt and pepper, and I mix it, and that's what I stuff the trout with.
Wow.
And then I sprinkle it with thyme and before I put it on the grill.
And after you wrapped it in foil, you put it on the grill. I've got it in front of me. 8
minutes
on each side.
He recommends the wrapping it in foil. I have stopped doing that because I get it crisper without the foil.
It's interesting that you recommend a certain kind of garlic, California Early or Persian Star.
Yes, California Early is a garlic that has been growing in California for many years. This recipe and the book was published 10 years ago. So since then, I have come to rely on my own garlics only, and I will use usually a Persian Star or one of my other favorites.
It's a mild garlic?
Yes, and it's one of the problems. I recommend it when I do a tasting anywhere or my little garlic song and dance anywhere. People ask about the various flavors in garlics, and I'm always quick to remind them that because we all have different body chemistries, we all have different reactions to taste. What might be hot for me could be mild for you.
How does a garlic tasting work? I mean, is it like a wine tasting? You kind of like take a little bite and then spit it out?
When you hear people at garlic tastings, I have done garlic tastings all over the country, it's as if they are talking about wine. Oh, it's at the back of the mouth. Oh, it hit me high on the palate. Oh, it makes my nose twitch or my eyebrows quiver. It's one of those kinds of languages that has eaten into the garlic even before I did.
This is an intriguing recipe. White almond garlic soup with grapes. What's the story on this one?
Well, I just served it the other day to some guests, and they went bonkers. Briefly, it's blanched almonds, white bread without crust, 10 cloves of garlic peeled, 6 cups of milk, 2 teaspoons sherry vinegar. And it says in the recipe in the book, 2 cups of extra virgin olive oil, but that's a mistake. It should be 1 cup of extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper. And I mix the almonds, bread, garlic, milk, vinegar in a blender, and then at medium speed. And then when I switch it on to high speed, I add the olive oil until the mixture is smooth. And I chill the soup for several hours. And then when I serve it, I serve it with the grape halves. And it will bring you all kinds of new friends.
If you don't mind, I mean, I have to tell our listeners a personal piece of information about you. You're 85 years old?
85 and 4 months and 3 days.
Does garlic keep you young?
Well, I'm actually 105, and my 30-year-old wife is pregnant for the third time.
I'll believe you. I'll believe you. You know, I think it's a wonderful recipe for staying young. But I'll tell you, you know, if I have people in the studio and I really like garlic, but I won't eat it before I, you know, for lunch or something. You know, I mean, garlic breath, let's face it, garlic sweat, the whole thing. Is there a cure for this?
Well, in Spain, when they serve garlic, they very often serve one of a variety of greens, including mint or basil or any of the greens, and with the high chlorophyll. Yes, sometimes some people do smell bad, but you have to make choices in life.
I think I'll go for that garlic pizza. And, you know, that parsley, it's not for garnish anymore. You just chew it afterwards.
That's right. That's right.
If it works. Chester Aaron is a garlic farmer in Occidental, California. He joined us from the studios of KRCB in Roanoke Park, California. Thanks for joining us, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Oh, thank you very much, Leanne.
You can find out more about Chester Aaron and his garlic, including the recipes from today's show, at chesteraaron.com. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.